Hello, welcome back to another episode of the Pharmacy Times Telltale Heart Podcast, the Cardiovascular Digest for Pharmacists. I'm excited today to continue our European Society of Cardiology coverage. However, it's going to be kind of a different flavor of coverage because I think it's an important conversation. We alluded to this in one of our last few episodes and really talk about meta-analyses and what that means or what makes a good meta-analysis and kind of some of the debate around some of these things that came out of ESC. And then the next few episodes, we'll get back to talking about primary literature, but I've brought, and actually this is going to be a fun fact for our guest today. He's our first repeat person on this podcast because he was on one of our first episodes at the ACC. So you've heard his voice before. So you're like you're slowly becoming the official friend of the pod. And so our first repeat guest. So in case people didn't catch you on the first one, Bill, will you tell everybody who you are and where you work and what you do?
Absolutely. Thanks, Craig. It's an honor to be on. I wish I had a better and more kind of smooth, silky voice for podcasting for the listening pleasure.
I think it's great. I think you and I both have a face for radio, right? No, I'm just kidding.
I love that. Yes, we do. So my name is Bill Baker. I'm a professor of pharmacy practice at the UConn School of Pharmacy in Connecticut. And I spend most of my time doing research. A lot of my training initially was in the field of systematic review and meta-analysis. And I think I probably, I haven't counted, but I'm guessing I published 50 to 60 of them somewhere in that range. And then I do a lot of other work, mostly in the observational large registry space, primarily with heart failure, advanced heart failure and heart transplant these days.
Very nice. And when I think of experts, at least in the pharmacy community, but probably even generally about performing meta-analyses or talking about them and putting them in context, I definitely always think about you and your expertise. And because to your point, you've done a lot of them. And so the reason I wanted to bring you on, and I don't know how much you got to pay attention to the European Society of Cardiology meeting, Bill, I'm sure you did, but a lot of angst were brought up about some of the data because we had some trials that were, I don't want to say they were negative, but they were not, maybe they didn't meet their primary endpoint, but then they met their secondary endpoint, i.e. vericiguat being one of them and being powered for death. But then, you know, they would do these meta-analyses that they presented and talk about the pooled data and what this means. And then the same thing, and we didn't have you pull this paper for this one, but the one that also got a lot of consternation is the dabigatran started an acute heart failure, which did not meet any of its primary or secondary endpoints. But then when they pulled the data together, it showed, yep, here's what this looks like. And so people were saying, well, you know, do we believe this or do we, you know, what do we do with this? So I wanted to take a aside to talk about this. And I've wanted to do this because I think as pharmacists, especially as we try to think applying literature and understand this and understanding where meta-analysis have value, because I think there is value in terms of guideline development and those things, what to do with this. But however, the other piece of this is after meetings like this, you'll see like 18 versions of a meta-analysis that you think is answering the same question. And you're, you know, how do you know which ones are done appropriately or approach these when you're looking at them to show value? So I think that's kind of a little bit what I wanted to get into. And so for the people at home, I think we're going to talk generally about them for a minute and then kind of contextualize that with the two that you pulled briefly. So just maybe high level, and you can go on whatever tangent you want to think through with this, but in your mind, what makes a good meta-analysis? Like, what do you want to approach when you look at this and say, here's what is a strong version of this? Is it looking for PRISM or what? You just like, so kind of start there.
Sure. And, you know, as you mentioned, I've been lucky enough to have been trained in the area of systematic review and meta-analysis, and I've done a lot of them. I have spent a lot of time peer reviewing them these days, and I do lecture on the topic still a fair amount. So this kind of more broadly is a topic that really hits home for me. And on your first ESC podcast, Rob DiDomenico made a comment about how when we see these new papers come out that are updates of meta-analyses where it's just one added trial that I roll my eyes, he's seen me do that more than a handful of times. So stepping back and looking at meta-analysis as a whole, when I think about if I'm reading a paper, whether it's something I'm peer reviewing for a journal or whether it's something I'm reading as a clinician or researcher or watching presented at a conference like ESC, there's a few things that come to mind. And the biggest one is this needed? And one of the interesting trends that we've seen in systematic review and meta-analysis in particular over the past, I would say, 15 years or so, is this explosion in the number of papers that have been published. And if you were to just go into PubMed and search for paper types by meta-analysis as a method, you're going to see almost an exponential increase in the number of papers with that methodology published in the past 20 years. And what you're not going to see is the similar increase in primary literature published. So what happens now is we will get a small number of RCTs published in a particular area, something like beta blockers post-MI or SGLT2s in hospitalized heart failure, to mention the few that you alluded to before. We could have maybe 2 to 4 papers published over a couple of year period. But as a result of those 2 to 4 papers, we could see literally dozens, if not hundreds, of systematic reviews published on these 2 to 4 RCTs. And the biggest problem I have with them is that, are they needed? And the simple answer to a vast majority of them is no, they're not. And so when I'm looking at a systematic review or a meta-analysis, the first thing I'm asking myself is, what is the unmet need that this paper is trying to address? Whether that be a clinical unmet need question, whether that be an unmet research question, whether that be an unmet policy question. I'm looking to see, have the authors or presenters clearly identified why this is needed? And for my money, the fact that one more trial happened to be published so I can update it and pad my CV with a new systematic review is in and of itself not a reason to do one. Yet that's what we most oftentimes see, is because we're dealing primarily with published literature, as long as you have access to those published papers, then you could pull the information from them. A lot of the software to do meta-analyses is freely available, and some of them are relatively user-friendly to operate and require minimal statistical savvy or knowledge. So you have ready access to the papers and their data. You have ready access to the software to do it. And so it can be pretty easy to really turn and burn with systematic reviews. And we're seeing some of these research groups in certain parts of the world just flood the medical literature with these papers, and most of them aren't really truly addressing a real unmet need.
And related to this, to capture this, and I don't know if you have looked at this or if somebody has researched this question, I don't recall seeing it. To the point what you're saying, how often are people redoing a meta-analysis by adding another piece of data, and it overall changes what the outcome of the meta-analysis was? Does that make sense? You get what I'm asking?
Like, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So how often are we seeing papers published adding one paper? Constantly. How often are the conclusions altered from one paper to another when that one additional study was included? Rarely.
Yeah.
It's kind of a twofold problem. There are instances where we have, let's say, preliminary data in areas. Maybe most of it is observational. A lot of it is high risk of bias, or in other words, kind of low quality. And then when a systematic review pulls this preliminary information together, it says, well, we have this answer. this answer is based on low quality evidence, so we need more research, but it's the best we have for now. And sometimes you then get follow-up with better done, or sometimes well done, clinical studies that address that same question, and then you can update what we knew now that we have better quality evidence. Does it change what we thought was the answer before when we only looked at that low quality evidence? That is we don't see that as often, but that can absolutely happen. What is more likely to be seen is, and we'll get to this with a couple of the papers today, where we have one, two, maybe three RCTs that are published that give sometimes different answers, and someone will pull them together to get what they think is the final answer. And then at next year's American Heart or next year's ACC or next year's ESC, another study will be published and they'll say, well, we had these big three ones before. Now we've got a fourth. Let's put them all together and see if our answer changes. Almost never does it. And if it does, it's because the populations were different. There was something fundamentally different about it. And so it didn't really move the needle necessarily in a positive way, I don't think.
Well, and I definitely want to elucidate some questions to this as we talk about the specific papers, especially when you talk about, you know, is this appropriate in the population? I think those are good questions to contextualize when we talk about it. Do you find this to be, and I don't want to inflame people or anyone who's, do you find this to be an abuse of meta-analysis? I guess maybe the question I'm asking is, like, when you think about this explosion, I mean, what is the intent of doing a meta-analysis? And sure, what do you think in your mind are the appropriate, because you said the question has to be appropriate, or what is the need? What makes something in your mind appropriate? Yeah. Like, this is when we should do a meta-analysis. You know what I mean? Yep.
So to answer your first question first, is this, you know, are individuals, research groups, collaboratives abusing systematic review meta-analysis as a study design? Without a doubt, 100% yes. There have actually been, for however you feel about his recent views post-COVID, one of the best known epidemiologists, John Ioannidis, did a look-see back in like 2016 or so in a particular area to see how many systematic reviews were done that answered a particular question, and then what was the quality of them, how many offered new information, how many addressed a prior unknown. And of the ones he looked at, I think only about 5% of them actually provided new knowledge, actually drove the field forward, and actually were well done. A vast majority of the ones he looked at were duplicative or methodologically poor. And I think the biggest problem with the current field, if you want to call it that, of systematic review and meta-analysis, is that they're really just CV padding. They're really just being done because they can, and because in our modern medical society, you can get anything published as long as you try, and maybe if you have a couple of dollars to support publication fees. So yes, I think that is a big problem. Now, why should meta-analyses be done? Why should systematic reviews be done? So meta-analysis itself is really a means of quantitatively combining results of research studies to provide an overall summary statistic. So meta-analysis is just the statistical approach that's done within a systematic review where you've systematically looked at the literature and found all the stuff that's been presented, published, whatever, addressing a particular topic. And then meta-analysis is just your statistical approach to combining them into one summary statistic. So when is this best often done? Well, as we're going to see when we get into these papers, its biggest advantage is in increasing power. So especially when you're looking at secondary outcomes for which primary trials were not initially published, whether you're looking at subgroup analyses for which a lot of main RCTs are obviously underpowered. When you pool a lot of studies together, not only is it forcing you to do a rigorous and hopefully objective evaluation of the evidence, its quality, its populations, how things differ, but it's also adding additional statistical power to show differences that may not have been readily apparent in some of those initial studies. So as we're going to see when we get into these papers, that was their primary objective for a couple of them. One, the beta blocker one in particular, where they were looking at subgroups of patients that the initial studies were just not powered to show. And when you combine a lot of subgroups together, sometimes it can reveal patterns of information that were not apparent when you read the individual studies themselves.
And all right, we'll jump into the articles here in a second. My last question, and we'll have questions. What are the strengths of doing a systematic review meta-analysis? What are the weaknesses, or sure. What are the things? Yep.
Yeah. I think, you know, the strengths are kind of some of the things that I just showed. They can be really time-saving, especially if it's an area where you're not intimately knowledgeable about the primary literature and you don't keep up on it, because there's thousands and thousands of journals out there and no human alive can keep up on all of it. And so systematic reviews in general, whether they're broad or whether they're pinpoint focused, can be really helpful, especially for the busy clinician who doesn't have time to read all the primary literature. If someone else, in hopefully an unbiased manner, has put everything together about a particular question, again, whether it be broad or narrow, into one place and said, this is what we know about this right now, that is wonderfully helpful. So that can be a big strength of this type of research methodology, and it can really help to identify what we know and what we don't know. And so it can not only advance our knowledge of an area, it can potentially drive and move practice, it can drive and move policy, including influencing guideline writing, and it can drive and move future research. Because like I said, we're not only can identify what we know, but we can sometimes, just as importantly, identify what we don't know. And so researchers can use that to kind of continue to push the boundary. So those are what I see as the biggest strengths of systematic review and meta-analysis as a research method. The weaknesses are inherent in what you put in. One of the biggest criticisms over the years of systematic review and meta-analysis is this idea of garbage in, garbage out. Just because I take a group of studies, I put some fancy statistics to it, and I make some pretty pictures, does not make the studies magically wonderful. And that's where looking at the quality of the underlying studies is really important. If I take a half a dozen poorly conducted studies that have really high risk of bias and I get one summary statistic, it doesn't make that pile of coal all of a sudden turn into a diamond. All I may have is a bigger pile of coal. And that may, if that's all we have, that's all we have. But too often I will see people make conclusions and make inferences on meta-analyses that are declarative when they are based on sometimes either inconsistent or really poor underlying quality of evidence, just like we see with kind of guideline recommendations. And so I see that as one of the biggest weaknesses, is the idea of garbage in, garbage out, and the idea of just there being so many of them and so many of them that don't really move the needle, as kind of being the biggest weaknesses. Because people won't give a critical understanding to the reader in their intro or in their discussion about what we actually know and the ways in which the current paper fills that gap. And so people can just read a paper, not getting a true reflection of what the reality of a field is. They can get conclusions if those conclusions aren't contextualized based on the quality of the evidence. A reader can take away something that may not be true or maybe over extrapolated.
Very good. And I think that's exactly why I wanted to do this today, because your points are exactly my points about understanding or people need to understand. So let's start out with the beta blockers after myocardial infarction with mildly reduced ejection fraction, an individual patient data meta-analysis of randomized controlled trials. This was published in Lancet at the same time of the meeting. So you can find it as the September 13, 2025, volume 406. So I guess, Bill, take us through, you give, suppose you're watching ESC like you had been doing, and you know, you see them present a couple of these trials, but then they do the sweeping meta-analysis. What are you starting out with? And when you're critically evaluating this meta-analysis, like, do you jump to the methods and say, you know, and then you're looking there? What, walk us through what you're doing to evaluate this.
So, sure. Well, as a researcher, I'm always jumping to the methods. But what I think is important for either listeners of this podcast or readers of this paper to understand, if we take a quick step back, is...
And real quick, before you do this, just the readers, these two articles will be in, they're open access. They're going to be in the reader notes. So if you want to click on them and follow them along while he does this, you can get a perspective. So, perfect. Sorry.
This paper is what they call an individual participant data meta-analysis. So a vast majority of meta-analyses we see published are using information from other published studies. So as I kind of mentioned before, you could have any number of studies from 2 to 100. And oftentimes meta-analyses will use summary data from those individual studies, and they will pool together that summary data. This paper is what they call an individual participant data meta-analysis. So instead of pooling together the summary values from each of the included beta blocker trials, they've gotten the raw clinical trial data from the investigators and pooled that together. So instead of having one, you know, hazard ratio of an entire trial or just the number of events over the number of total patients randomized in each arm, they have the raw data from every person that was included in those clinical trials, and that's what they're pooling together. So this style of meta-analysis is very different from a lot of others in that it's using the raw individual participant data rather than the summary data.
And does that provide strength, more strength to the meta-analysis, or is it completely different?
It's different because... imagine how difficult it would be for an independent person to go to the primary authors on these four beta blocker trials and say, hey, I want to do a meta-analysis on your studies. Give me all the data that you spent a decade collecting so that I can do a paper and have a publication. And sure, I'll throw your name on it. Imagine how difficult that would be to facilitate, right? So it is very difficult oftentimes to get raw data from people. It's a lot easier just to pull their individual kind of their summary statistics.
No, their outcomes, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So it's important to understand. So the benefit of this is that you can really deep dive into trends a lot more, because you're not just limited to the sample size of four. Because if I was pooling the individual summary effects from these four beta blocker trials, my N would be four. Even though each study included hundreds of patients, each one in a traditional meta-analysis is only giving one summary effect. And so my effective N would be four. My effective number of effects would be four. Rather, if you look at this paper, rather than having one summary statistic for each one of them, you have the total raw number of individuals that were included in there, which was, I think, what, 1,900 or something along those lines. So you can really drill down a lot more into subgroup effects. You can drill down a lot more into effect modifiers in particular, because you don't have an effective N of four, you have an effective N of 1,900. And so you can really deep dive a lot more into those things.
Sure. Okay. So you start there, you look at, you know, that kind of design work, and you alluded to picking trials. Is there, you know, and obviously I know different questions have different degrees of patient enrollment, right? So like, obviously we're very fortunate in a lot of cardiology domains that some of the trials are very large and robust, but there's no magic number. Like, you only want to include trials of X amount of people, or, you know what I mean? Do you get what I'm asking? Like, when you're thinking about how they design these things?
No. So, it depends on the field. There are some fields where we have lots of large clinical trials, and so it would make sense to only include ones that are above a certain size. So if I know there's five RCTs that have 10,000 patients each, am I going to want to include that 50-person single-center study into it? Maybe not. So it really kind of depends on the field. Now, with this beta blocker trial, what was individual IPD or individual participant data meta-analysis? I'll just say IPD for
now,
because it's shorter.
Sure.
With this one, what they did is instead of including all of the patients randomized in all the trials, they were only interested in a subset. So they were only interested in those individuals randomized in these trials that had kind of mildly reduced EFs, the EFs of 40 to 49%. So all of these trials had patients that were randomized who had EFs of 40% or higher. They were only interested in looking at the impact of beta blockers in the subset of these trials where they had EFs of 40 to 49. And that's a good example of when an IPD like this can be really beneficial, because maybe not every one of the original trials reported a subgroup analysis with that specific EF range. And so having all the raw data can help them really drill down and say, we think this might be a range in which these drugs are particularly beneficial or particularly harmful, or whatever the case may be. And so this is a perfect methodology where you can do that and say, I only want to look at this subgroup of patients. And so of all the raw data they got, they limited it to just that narrow subset of individuals within those trials and then pooled them all together.
And just real quick before we go on, what would be some, if you were looking at the methods, like red flags of like, I'm not sure about this, you know?
Right. With IPD meta-analyses, the biggest thing is, and really with any meta-analysis, is how homogeneous or similar, easier to say similar, are the populations at baseline, right? So how similar are the study designs? How similar were the patient populations at baseline? How similar were the interventions? How similarly defined, at least, were the outcomes? Things like that. And these are methods that I always look at for any type of systematic review or any type of meta-analysis, not just an IPD one like this. I want to make sure that they're combining like with like. And so in this paper, they actually mentioned that they limited it to just these four trials, because they were done in a more contemporary fashion. So yes, we've had post-MI beta blocker trials for many years, but a lot of them were before the advent of modern medical management of people who have experienced an ACS. They were before we started doing routine PCI and before doing routine drug-eluting stents and kind of our routine modern management of this population. And so it wouldn't make sense to pool data on beta blockers from trials that were before the modern era, because they're just not representing our current reality and they're not representing what we currently see. And they're likely answering, as a result, a very different question. And so when I'm looking at a meta-analysis like this, the first thing I'm looking to do is see what are the populations that they included. So how did they identify these studies, and really how similar are they between them, and are they similar enough to pool together in one place? You know, so, and I think when we look at this paper, they very well achieve that.
Yeah, and then this is a good point. You know, I think they are very clear that they want a contemporary analysis of this very subset population. And so it's good, because if you had older data in there, you'd be like, how generalizable is this outcome going to be, right? And so I think that those are things that people need to have a keen eye to look for.
Okay. Yes. Yeah.
So just that, let me ask you this question. If you see this sometimes, you know, they use a Prisma process or do something. Do you look for those type, and it's not necessarily in this paper, but do you look for those types of acknowledgements that they had a defined process or followed? Like if they don't mention that, do you get concerned? Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. So for those that are unfamiliar, Prisma stands for Preferred Reporting Items for Systematic Review and Meta-Analysis. And It's a group of guidance documents where individuals that want to disseminate the results of their systematic review and meta-analysis should follow to make sure they have all of these items in their paper. or in their presentation or in their abstract or whatever. They have a bunch of different kind of sub Prisma papers. What Prisma does is it's a reporting guidance. It is not a methods guide. It is not a how-to guide.
Right.
It's not a, I want to do a systematic review. Let me sit down with Prisma and make sure I know how to do everything right. It's, I've already done one. Let me make sure that the paper I'm writing of that project is reported clearly. So I want to make sure that they kind of follow that. And another interesting thing with systematic review that we don't see universally accepted yet is, was the protocol a priori defined and was it published anywhere? So we're very used to seeing this with RCTs where, you know, I want to see, was it registered on clinicaltrials.gov? Does it have an NCT number? I can go and I can compare the original protocol listed on clinicaltrials.gov with the published paper I'm reading to make sure that they kind of aligned. With systematic review, there are sources where you can do that, where they say we kind of a priori put together a protocol and we publish this protocol somewhere. And there's a couple of different repositories where they can list that they did that. And as a reader, I can compare their initial protocol with what they initially presented. So for this beta blocker paper, as an example, they pre-specified and registered their systematic review on a database called Prospero. It's run out of the UK and they give you their number. So you can, it's a free available website. You can go onto Prospero just like you do with clinicaltrials.gov and you can put in their a number and you can see the a priori specified protocol that they put together to make sure there was no, no shenanigans. And so when I see that someone not only put together a protocol ahead of time, they pre-specified things, they registered the protocol, that makes me, it gives me a lot more confidence that what they did was intentional. It doesn't mean what they did was right. It doesn't mean what they did was accurate. It doesn't mean that what they found is true, but it tells me that they were intentional about the decisions that they made. They know what they're doing in general. And right off the bat, that gives me a lot more confidence in the methods I'm about to read.
Sure. Okay. So are you ready to, anything yeah. else on the methods or do you want to move to the results?
No, let's move to the results because sure. I think that's yeah. kind of the meat on the bone here.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. So where I think situations like this create a lot of confusion for meeting attendees or readers is when they presented this IPD, it was preceded by the presentations of two of the trials included in the IPD. So they presented Reboot, and then they presented Batami and Dan Block as a kind of a combined RCT. One of them found a benefit. One of them found a null effect. I don't like the word negative because it suggests harm. But one of them found a benefit, kind of one of them found a null effect. And then they come in and they present this meta-analysis that finds a benefit and people are really confused. It's like, well, do we believe the RCTs or do we believe the meta-analysis, right? So if you look at the main results of this paper, their primary outcome, which was a composite of all-cause death, new MI, or heart failure, was non-statistically significantly reduced. In the individual studies, but when they were pooled together, it was statistically significantly reduced. And then when they looked at the individual components of that, there was not statistically significant reductions in all-cause death, new MI, or heart failure individually, but there was for the composite. A lot of people might be confused at that because they might say, well, the two primary studies that make up three quarters of the data in here showed different effects. If you want to look at a high line,
yep.
The meta-analysis composite outcome showed a statistical reduction in this composite outcome favoring beta blockers, but the individual outcomes didn't. And so readers are going to be like, well, what do I do with that? And I think this really highlights to me two different things. One of the benefits, and I mentioned this before, a strength of meta-analysis and systematic review is to increase power. And so I think this is a perfect example of in this subgroup, remember, because this wasn't all the patients in all the trials, it was just the subgroup that had the EF of 40 to 49. What it says is, to me, at least anyway, there might be something there. That something is likely a modest, at best, effect size, but it's something. You know, it's we likely don't have enough events to show benefit in all-cause death with beta blockers if they have an EF of 40 to 49%. We don't have enough events to show they prevent subsequent recurrent MI or that they prevent new heart failure. But when you look at it as a collective, there was a significant benefit to the composite there. So to me, that means there's something here. It doesn't mean that it doesn't work and that we should avoid it. At the same time, to me, it doesn't mean I put every person with an, you know, post-MI with an EF of 40 to 49% on a beta blocker. But it means there's something there.
Right.
You know, and that really forces you to look at the nuance of the different patient populations to see, you know, and they had some great discussion in the panel after these individual studies to say, you know, was it the difference in populations? Was it the difference in countries or sites? Was it the difference in the beta blocker themselves that they used? You know, should they have all used timolol? Should they have all used only metoprolol? Did it really matter? It can really lend itself more to say beta blockers might benefit people that have this kind of mildly reduced EF. To what degree, we don't know, but there seems to be something here, and we need to continue looking into this because people might benefit. It's something we might want to do. It's not going to be a class one guideline recommendation, but this is something we need to continue to look at to be defined to say not only who the best candidate is, but what the best candidate drug is, maybe the best candidate dose is. We need to continue looking at this because there's something here. It's something we should consider doing, and it's something we should absolutely continue to research.
So it really is driving hypothesis generation, saying, look, yeah, maybe something here in these mildly reduced EF patients when we pull this data together. And I'm like, and if I'm looking just at like figure four, like some of the pre-specified subgroup analysis, it's like, maybe we need to study it in in-STEMI patients that are mildly reduced or something to that effect. If you look at, you know, where it favors the beta blocker or not, you know, it could drive a hypothesis of like maybe a different type of trial design, right?
Right. Yeah, or like, exactly. Yeah. One interesting caveat, a caution that I want to put out when you look at subgroup analysis, like figure four in this paper, is when they, and I'll make this, it's a bigger mention with the Vericiguat paper, is to be very cautious about when continuous things are categorized. And the one in particular is age. So if you look at age, what they saw was essentially a null effect whatsoever in those that were over the age of 75 with that primary composite of beta blockers. But if you just looked at those that represented a majority of the population that were under the age of 75, it was statistically significant. So most of the benefits seemed to be in the under 75 versus over 75. And now clinicians, you might think to yourself, oh, okay, well, that's interesting to know. Maybe I won't give my beta blockers if they're over 75. But that suggests that there's some physiologic difference between a patient, all else being equal, who is 74 years of age, who would benefit, versus someone that's 76 years of age that would get nothing from it. And obviously, biologically, that's nonsensical. And so be very careful when you're looking out randomly categorized groupings of continuous variables like age, even right, like EF. When we get to the Vericiguat, the same thing with BNP. You know, I would much have preferred to see that on a continuous scale because everything is moving. Nature does not dichotomize anything. It just does not work that way.
Right.
And be very careful when you were looking at subgroups where authors do that. Now, obviously, it's not malicious, but it's hypothesis generating at best.
Sure.
Sometimes confusing. Absolutely.
And that's a beautiful point. And I think, you know, that's why I kind of gravitated towards maybe STEMI versus NSTEMI, because that's a little bit more defined, right? Like we know what that is and who those people are from that standpoint.
Yeah. And that could be certainly hypothesis generating because we're looking at subgroups of a subgroup. Remember, this population was a subgroup of the main study. And so when you're looking at the NSTEMI subgroup of this pooled subgroup, you can see how this should not be determinative, but it can be like, there seems like there's something here. This is something we need to continue to look at.
So let me ask you this question with this paper. Do you think this would be a paper that influences guidelines or really just more
derives research hypotheses. Does that make sense? Do you get what I'm asking?
Both. I think it absolutely can drive guidelines because there's something here. Like, I don't think you could look at this research in its collective and make a broad statement of we need to no longer give beta blockers to patients post-MI, right? That would not be supportive of the data. Would it be a class one recommendation to say give all patients post-MI a beta blocker? No, it would not as well. So I think guideline committees would absolutely consider this in their recommendations with the caveat that this is a pooled analysis of a subgroup of trials. And so it's some evidence, but it's not definitive per se. And absolutely it is hypothesis generating for future research because now we want to know, and it doesn't have to be additional, you know, more, you know, 5,000 patient RCTs, but even if you're looking at future registry data, you can want to say, does our observational studies, if we limit it to, you know, those that are mildly reduced EF that are maybe younger that had an NSTEMI, is that our magic sweet group? Is that our magic sweet spot? We can continue to look at that and say, is there additional signal here that is supportive of this IDP meta-analysis finding?
Very good. So let's take a moment and switch to the other one, and we can add to this, you know, in the last few minutes, and we'll have to go as in-depth because we did a lot of this, but
right,
comparing and contrasting. So this is virsovot for patients with heart failure and reduced ejection fraction across the spectrum, an individual participant. This is also an individual participant data analysis for Victoria or Victoria, and this is also in the Lancet, the same edition. This was August 30th, 2025 is when this one was published, but kind of different. Obviously a different population in trial, but kind of when you approach this, anything that is similar or different or things that you would think about differently with this one versus the other one?
Yeah, this one was different in a lot of different ways. You know, whereas the beta blocker IDP was meant to pool studies in a particular subset of patients from the main trials, this virsovot paper took all patients of the two trials and put them together. Now, what they didn't do is take all patients of all virsovot trials ever done. They just took these two. So it was very selective of just these two particular studies. And, you know, obviously Victoria was the initial study that was done and led to the approval of virsovot, at least in the U.S. and in other places, for the heart failure population. And then Victor was the trial that was just presented at ESC. And as you mentioned, the populations of these are very different, you know, and they kind of resulted in very different results individually. So I think there are a couple of different considerations with this paper versus the beta blocker paper in that it was only two trials, but it was all of the participants in there. And the populations of the patients were different, at least, you know, somewhat different. Victoria was a sicker population who had kind of a recent worsening of their heart failure. Victor was an incredibly well treated population that had no evidence of a recent worsening. So they were kind of a better treated, less sick, if you will,
right,
population. Their claim was that this was a benefit, not a bug. So even though the populations were somewhat different, they view that as a positive because they wanted to better represent people across the spectrum of heart failure, including those that were more stable and those that had a recent worsening, to give a better kind of broad picture of how virsovot performs in a broader population. So it was a very different approach where the virsovot paper was trying to be much more catch-all, whereas the beta blocker paper was intentionally trying to be much more narrow in its.
And I'm going to ask this question because clearly, obviously, it got published in the Lancet, and these are very well authors, and I know a lot of them. So I'm not. This is not to be critical, but does it give you pause that they combine the two different populations like this in a mixed version of that? You know what I mean? Like,
right, right. Not inherently. It all depends on the methods that they would then use, because we have to remember that these are patients that were included for each individual trial over different time periods. They had different background therapies. They had different comorbidities, and they were randomized at different times to varseglot or placebo. And so if you put them together, it doesn't automatically make this one bigger RCT. You're still combining two different RCTs. And so any statistical methods, which most people don't look at, have to take into account that type of clustering, where it has to factor in that these are two different studies. Yes, we can put them together, and yes, we can gain additional insight, but it's not one big, brand new, beautiful trial that has a ton of more people. It's still two different ones that were put together. So is it wrong that they did it? No, absolutely not. It's perfectly fine, and it's pretty commonly done now, and it's pretty commonly a priori specified that they're going to do this, and we can gain a lot of insight into it, but it's not the end all be all. It is not declarative. And I think that Dr. McMurray in his discussion of this kind of gave great insight and said, I think this is interesting and wonderful information, but it gives me more questions than it does answers.
Which is definitely because the contradiction, and we talked about this with the study, is that you had it not meet its primary endpoint per se,
right?
But it did reduce death, which it was super powered for. And in essence, it was a null trial. But then you had this meta-analysis that says there's benefit. And so, I think this is where a lot of people have lots of questions about meta-analysis as a whole after this, is because people are like, well, and to your point, he said this is just interesting information, but we still have to say that. And then a lot of people are arguing, well, death is death, right? Like it's not a softer endpoint relatively, and it was powered. So what was your takeaway after seeing all this, or when you read this meta-analysis? Like what was striking to you? What was good? What was, what was the take that you're like, oh, this is good? And what you think should be the next step based on this meta-analysis?
Sure. So it's interesting, when you look at the individual studies where you look at Victoria, the primary outcome of the composite of CV death and heart failure hospitalization was significant, but it was entirely driven by reductions in heart failure hospitalization with no real impact on CV death, right? And some of the subsequent guideline recommendations reflected that. With Victor, what was interesting is there was really no impact on hospitalization, but there was significant impacts on mortality and significant impacts on different types of mortality, CV death, all cause, things like that. So it really kind of showed different things. And then when you look at the IDP, where they were combined together in a broader, more general population, I think what it did is it gave more power to these small effects. And I think it kind of reflects what we're going to see moving forward in particularly HFrEF management, where if they're on good quad therapy, guideline-directed medical therapy, gone are the days where we're going to see 30% reductions in MI, or excuse me, in death, like we did with the early beta blocker and ACE trials. Like if someone's on a good, quad guideline-directed medical therapy, almost nothing we're going to add now is going to further reduce mortality by 30%. It's almost an impossibility to expect. What we can see potentially is something that could benefit, but it's going to result in a smaller absolute benefit when added on top of good treatment. And I think what this IPD meta-analysis does is it says varseglot can do that. If you look at the effect sizes, at the absolute effect sizes are modest. The numbers needed to treat were much bigger than we've seen with other trials, even if you go back and look at Paradigm with sacubitril valsartan and things like that. The absolute treatment effects, even the relative treatment effects, are much more modest, but they seem to be real. So it's almost a similar takeaway that I have from the beta blocker IDP, where whereas I was kind of lukewarm, and I think many clinicians were, about varseglot after just Victoria, thinking this is another drug like DIDGE or some of these others where, yeah, if it's the right population, we can add it on. It'll make them feel better. It'll keep them out of the hospital, which is a wonderful thing. But that may be it. Whereas now, when we look at it, we might say more broadly, well, maybe there's more to it. Maybe, you know, we're not going to use this over an SGLT2. We're not going to use this over, you know, over sacubitril valsartan. It's still an add-on, but maybe instead of waiting for the right person to add on where we could get the Victoria style benefit, what this IDP to me suggests is maybe it could be the next thing you add on, assuming no contraindications to everyone, because even if the mortality benefit is modest, it seems like it's still there. You know, we still have a lot of lingering questions about the hospitalization and the mechanism by which vericiguat leads to these benefits, but it could shift how people feel about the drug from this is a niche thing to, you know, is it the fifth pillar? I don't know. We might not be there yet. I don't want to speak for others or guideline writers, whatever. I don't think we're there yet, but it might be. Maybe it's leaning that way, and maybe we're shifting more towards that thinking than we are the niche thinking that we were if we just looked at Victoria.
Yeah. No, and that's, I think, my current takeaway on this. So this has been great and super insightful. Maybe we will find in the future some non-ID, you know, individual patient level data meta-analyses. But any parting thoughts on this?
The only one that I do want to mention, just to kind of tie a bow on one point I made with the beta blocker paper, is the authors in the vericiguat IDP made a big deal about the BNP cutoff, and they showed some wonderful spline figures where they showed how the treatment effect for the different mortality outcomes and the composite outcomes kind of changes across the spectrum of BNP, where the effect is somewhat attenuated as you go up. And they made a very big point about dichotomizing that at a BNP of 6,000. Absolute, utter statistical nonsense. There's no reason to say the drug would not have effect if your BNP was 6,001, but it would have an effect if it was 5,999. Right. It's nonsensical, and it doesn't even match the results that they showed. So if you're reading that, be very careful on that interpretation, and basically, I think, ignore it. Now, why the drug effect is attenuated as BNP goes up, I don't know. But BNP is a moving target anyway, and it's going to change day to day once we manage, you know, volume and pressure and all that. So I personally ignore that almost entirely as a cutoff. It's meaningless.
Yeah, no, I love what you said. That's a great way to think about it. You know, nothing in nature is dichotomous, right?
In very few things, but
yeah,
very good.
Yes.
So, Bill, you know, I appreciate you taking the time, and this has been so enlightening. Hopefully, it'll be a teaching tool for others. You know, as always, you know, I know we talked to you about this in April. I know you were doing some sports and things. Anything you're watching or doing or reading now, or that is not pharmacy related? I know it's football season started. You're probably following that whole piece, but
yes, I don't have a rooting interest in any particular NFL team, even though I'm in New England. I am more of a fantasy football guy, so weekends are absolutely magical for me from just enjoying the sport and watching it. I am a Red Sox fan, though, so when we're getting down to crunch time, and so the baseball playoffs are coming, and that is taking up a lot of my time. So when I do have downtime as leisure, it's usually taken up by one of those two sports endeavors.
Gotcha. Very good. All right. Well, that is great. I look forward to seeing you at HFSA in a week or so. As everybody, always the housekeeping. If you like what we're doing, please like, subscribe, rate. I know Bill has done that. I appreciate that. And, you know, please, you know, give us a good review. If you have things you want to hear or you want to be on the podcast or guests, please reach out to us. And Bill, thank you for your time.
Thanks, Craig. Appreciate it.
Yep. Bye-bye. See you guys in a couple weeks when we continue our ESC coverage. Have a good one.